Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast where I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My non-random guest tonight is Annalee Flowerhorn. I had to think in my head to make sure I pronounced it correctly, hence the pause. Annalee, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. So could you tell the folks a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am a science fiction writer from Washington, D.C. I had a story out last summer in the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. I'm also a regular blogger for the Geek Feminism blog, where we talk about, a lot of pop culture stuff and how it relates to feminism and geeks and et cetera.
Excellent. That's exciting. It's an exciting perspective to have on here because it is, this might shock you, but it is very easy to find dudes who are willing to talk about Star Trek.
Really?
Yes, I know, it's shocking.
These mythical male geeks.
So I'm trying my darndest to get a diverse viewpoints, because I feel like Star Trek speaks to so many different people, and that I should not just talk to other white guys about Star Trek. And that's not the only reason that you are on, but you were recommended by a friend of ours, and you're a science fiction writer. You have all the credentials. Not that you need credentials to be on here, but in case anyone who's listening says, why am I not on? It was because you didn't get a recommendation, so too bad for you. But anyway, tell me a little bit about – here's my question that I ask everyone. Would you consider yourself a Star Trek fan?
I do consider myself a Star Trek fan. I am totally okay being called a Trekkie. I'm also okay being called a Trekker, but I don't have an opinion on the Trekkie versus Trekker divide.
But you consider yourself one of them.
I consider myself both. I mean, they both mean the same thing as far as I'm concerned. And I know that there are people that are like grabbing their armrests and going, no, they don't. But I respect that. And I will call people Trekkers if they prefer the term. But I'm good with either one.
I was watching one of the Captain documentaries or something.
Mm-hmm.
And what's her name? Captain Janeway,
Mulgrew.
There you go. Kate Mulgrew was talking
about.
She's
also fantastic in Orange is the New Black.
Yes, she is. Here's my theory. I think that is all taking place on the holodeck of the Voyager. but that's another podcast, or maybe some fan fiction that I'm working on. Anyway, she was talking about the whole Trekker versus Trekkie thing. I'm pretty sure it was her. And she said that she likes to think of people as Trekkers because that is an active thing. Like, you are actively involved. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a Trekkie, you're kind of, just kind of going with the flow.
Mm-hmm.
Which I like. I mean, I have no real preference either way. I just like that thinking. So I think of myself as a Trekker just because I like to think of myself mm-hmm. as an active fan for whatever reason. Whatever that means. I don't know. So you're a Star Trek fan. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite series?
See, this is a tough question.
I ask the tough questions here.
So I'm going to say something that is I'm going to go ahead and speak blasphemy here. I actually am really fond of Voyager. I'm also really fond of TNG. TNG and Voyager are probably my two favorite series. I know that a lot of people hate Voyager, and you know.
Well, I was thinking. Yeah. So I've heard there's been a lot of love for Voyager on this podcast mm-hmm. from guests, not from me. but I was I wasn't afraid, but I thought you were going to say Enterprise.
No, that would be actual blasphemy.
Now, there has been a couple of people who have picked Enterprise as their favorite series. But I have come – when I started this little project of mine, I was down on Voyager because
mm-hmm.
I hadn't rewatched it in forever. And when I first saw it, I didn't like it. And I think mostly because there was a woman captain, and I was like, "What the hell? This is freaking me out, man." I was immature. It was mm-hmm. there were different times, but now upon rewatching some episodes, there are certainly characters that I extremely dislike. Captain Janeway is not one of them, though. I think she's one of the best characters in Star Trek.
Yeah, I really love her. And being a girl growing up in the 90s and watching, I mean, that show passed the – you're familiar with the Bechdel test?
I am.
So are your viewers, readers, listeners familiar? Should we recap it for them?
Let's recap it.
Okay. So the Bechdel test is that you have to have at least two female characters, and they have to talk to each other about something other than a man. You would be amazed how many things fail that test. Pretty much every movie that's nominated for an Oscar, all of them.
And the episode of
Star Trek.
Yes, this episode of Star Trek that we are going to talk about, I think, fails that test.
Yep. But a lot of Voyager passes that test because B'Elanna and Janeway are constantly talking to each other about engineering. And, you know, representation is really great. And when you were a young girl and getting to see people talk about science, it is pretty cool. So that's one of the reasons that I really love Voyager. I acknowledge that the sort of overarching plot, specifically when they got into doing with the Borg, was not it could have been better.
I like Janeway. I like B'Elanna. I even like Seven of Nine, although I question her choice of costume. It wasn't her choice. The costume that they gave her, I should say. I think she did a fantastic job and developed as a fantastic character, despite early indications that she was just there for her looks.
She was a very talented actress. We all know that they hired her because they wanted, you know, to boost the ratings by putting somebody in a cat suit. But she was a very talented actress.
Yes, it was surprising. So this is – I often bring up there's an Enterprise scene in, I think, the first episode in which two characters are rubbing decontamination
gel. Oh, yeah, the gel rubbing scene.
Yes.
Yes.
As the point at which Enterprise lost me.
Yeah. So there are things I like about Enterprise, too, and I hear it got better later and I didn't sort of keep up with it. I'm going to speak blasphemy. I really like the opening – I like the theme song for Enterprise.
Well, now you are the first person on this podcast to like that song. So
I will occasionally just rock out to this song. I like the little opening sequence with the like ship and then like it's getting, you know, from the sailing vessels to the early spaceships. I'm like, that is hopeful and inspiring. And they totally rip that song off from Patch Adams, but we're going to roll with it.
I really like the intro sequence of Enterprise. I think it's great and really gets you in the mood for the setting of the show. But that song, I can't get on board with that song. I'm sorry. But that's the beauty of this podcast. As I often say, I do not judge other people's fandoms. I just question it.
There may be fan fiction sitting on my hard drive somewhere in which Starfleet cadets are having that song at their graduation.
Oh, I could get behind that because that is greatly amusing.
Right?
Yeah. Right. You've got me on board. In that very specific scenario, I'm a fan of the song.
So that's my headcanon for the song, though, right? Is that like all of the Starfleet graduates, like that's their like graduation song.
I love that. I think that needs to – I'm going to edit Memory Alpha if I can and make that into official canon. Because it should be.
Might get shunted to Memory Beta.
Yes. I need to do it. It might be. But I'll keep fighting the fight because that should be
awesome.
True.
Nobody can tell us it's not.
Exactly. It's you know, it's a shared universe. We can make up stuff. So Voyager you like, which is, you know, my main problem with Voyager, like I said, wasn't Captain Janeway, because I think she's a great character. It wasn't B'Elanna, because I also think she's a great character. Seven of Nine, great character. Chakotay, Tom Paris, not a fan. What's his face? Harry Kim. Oh, I dislike Harry Kim immensely.
They almost killed him off.
Several times.
Yeah, no, but they actually were going to kill him off. They were going to replace him with Seven of Nine.
I didn't know that.
Then, yeah, the actor that was playing him, whose name I'm blanking on, Garrett Wang.
Anyway,
he got on to 50 Most Beautiful People that year. And so they were like, oh, I guess we have to fire Jennifer Lean instead.
Well, that's sad.
That's actually how that happened.
Well, you know, he's not a bad looking guy, but his character, awful. Neelix,
yeah,
of course.
I try not to blame him for that because, you know, he didn't write the character, but.
That's true.
Yeah, they could have given him more opportunities to do things with that character. Neelix, once Kes left, because Neelix and the Neelix-Kes relationship honestly grossed me out a little. not because it was interspecies, but because she was two.
Right.
It was a little weird. But after she left, I actually thought Neelix's character developed quite nicely.
I'm not sure. I have to. Well, so I have blocked out so much about Neelix that I can neither agree or disagree with that. I've seen for this podcast, Voyager in our early run came up a lot in the mm-hmm. random episode selection. So I've seen a lot of episodes with that feature Neelix. Most notably, the one in which his lungs are stolen.
Yeah, that's not a good look for him.
No, it's not a good look for anybody.
And, yeah.
It's not a good episode.
Yeah, but he gets sort of a lot less anxious and also a lot less jealous later in the show because his sort of possessiveness of Kes is actually kind of gross. But later, you know, when he sort of develops and figures out who he is and stops being such a jerk, he actually gets a really cool character arc.
Yes, well, I will agree, since I don't remember what happens in later episodes of Voyager, so I'll take your word for it. So let me ask you, so I have this theory,
mm-hmm.
which is I mention on every episode, so listeners are probably like, oh, enough with this theory, McNulty. But I think that whatever Star Trek you are first exposed to
mm-hmm.
becomes kind of your – the way you think of Star Trek. It is your Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So was Voyager your first kind of major in-depth exposure to Star Trek?
It was probably the first show – it was definitely the first show that I watched in order while it was on because I watched TNG and I had seen episodes of TNG before Voyager came on, but I hadn't watched the whole of TNG yet. I actually really like TNG. TNG and Voyager are pretty tied for me for faves.
Well, that makes sense. They are almost the same show.
Well, that's the thing is I think a lot of people give Janeway sort of – are we allowed to cuss on your podcast?
We are.
Okay. People give Janeway for things that Picard does all the time. And they're like, Picard is such a badass. He just did this thing. And then Janeway does it and they're like, she's a frigid bitch. Like, really? Really?
Well, I think this speaks to Star Trek's fans are mostly male. I think I can say that fairly safely without doing any research whatsoever. And I feel like – and this is true, I'm sure, that you know men see attributes that you know authority figures have that are male and think, mm-hmm. oh, that means he's a strong leader. They mm-hmm. see the same attributes in a female leader and they think, ugh. Reminds me of my mother, how she can't boss me around. What's wrong with her?
Yeah, I'm not actually so sure about the gender breakdown on Trek fans. I think, and this is becoming less true, but certainly in the 90s, female fans sort of expressed their fandom differently and in ways that got on a lot. You know, like the fan fiction communities, everyone's like mm-hmm. poo-pooing fan fiction. Well, it happened to be that an overwhelming majority of the people that were writing fanfic were women, and they had sort of been pushed out of the mainstream fan community, and so they went and made their own, and then everybody else on it.
Well, isn't that the way of the world? Men are jerks. Well, you could be right.
Not all men.
Well, a lot of men. I see what you did there. I have no idea what the gender breakdown is, but I imagine I'm hopeful. I would assume it's 50-50, except that it's an interesting point. You say that women express their fandom differently because, you know, if you go to a convention or something, it's a lot of guys dressed up like mm-hmm. Klingons or whatever. Also, women there as well, but it, mm-hmm. it seems like it's predominantly male.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that means, but that's what I'm saying. Although I've never been to a Star Trek convention either, so what do I know? This is my shocking admission. People are going to stop listening.
Oh, no.
I've never been to a Star Trek convention.
I've been to more general conventions that have Star Trek fans at them.
A subsection. I'm not big into conventions, mostly because I don't like large gatherings of people.
Well, yeah, that would be – conventions would be contraindicated for that.
Yes, I'm a hermit. That's what we've learned today. And I don't like dressing up. It seems like a lot of effort. I am
– Oh, I love it.
I admire people for doing it because it's so much effort and people really get into it, but I'm just lazy.
I used to work in costume shops, so I do not fool around about dressing up. I have a copy of the Kaylee layered cake dress from Firefly, and I'm trying to put together a good Delenn from Babylon 5 with the head bone and everything.
Have you ever dressed up as a Star Trek character?
Yes. For a Halloween party that I was hosting, and so I was running around like crazy and didn't actually have time to make a costume, I pulled a blue duster thing out of my – it kind of looks like Dr. Crusher's coat
mm-hmm.
Out of the back of my costume closet, and then I took some face – I'm blanking on the name for it. It's wax that you use to make prosthetics and stuff out of. And I shaped it into a little Bajoran bone ridge. So I was some random Bajoran doctor.
Well, that's good enough, I think. That's more than I would have done. I would have just said, oh, I'm a future civilian. Ooh. Well, all right. So let's talk about, let's segue smoothly into the episode in which we are going to discuss tonight, which is the ensigns or ensigns of command. I'm not sure how to say. Mm-hmm. I guess it's ensigns. I don't know.
I want to say it's ensigns, but yeah.
Who knows? Someone will correct me, and I look forward mm-hmm. to that. Season 3, Episode 2. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think it's easy, okay to categorize it as a Data episode.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I like Data. What do you think about Data?
I'm actually, I mean, obviously, is it Brent Spiner or Brent Spinner? Because I can never tell.
I think it's Spiner.
Okay. He is a fantastic actor. And, like, I think at the beginning of the series, they kind of didn't know that, and then they figured it out, and we're just like, okay, we're just going to let him, like, do all the things because he's awesome. So I actually, you sort of start to see the arc that we then see completed throughout the rest of the series and the films in these earlier episodes with him. I'm a big fan of his. I thought it was really funny the particular ways in which he failed to understand what was going on in this episode.
You know, Data is always good for failing to understand these humans and their needs. And he's put into this situation where he needs to I'll do a very brief recap, and then we can talk about some particulars.
Okay.
The Enterprise gets hailed by the Sheliak, who are these reclusive aliens who do not contact people very often, and say, hey, we've got this planet that we've signed this treaty about, but we've signed a larger treaty. This planet falls within the boundaries. There are humans there. Get them off. We're settling in 4 days. And so the Enterprise is like, all right, well, let's go. They go. There's this bunch of radiation in this planet so that humans can't live down there.
Except for the ones that do.
Yes, except for who apparently have figured out how to live down there through hand-wavy science fiction. And so they say, okay, well, we can't. Our transporters don't work in this radiation for some reason, and phasers don't work in this radiation, and humans can't live down there, so we'll have to send Data, because there's probably a couple people down there. Data can put them in his shuttlecraft, and we'll fly away, and everyone will be happy. So Data's like, okay, he goes down there, he finds out that there are 15,000 people down there, and now it's his job to negotiate with them and convince them that they should evacuate before the Sheliak show up and destroy them, because the Sheliak apparently think of humans as vermin, which, you know, I can see that.
I mean, considering I actually really like the puppets, the Sheliak puppets, but, you know, if you were rocking out your little, I don't actually know how to describe their Sheliak puppetness. It looks like something out of the Creature Workshop.
It's like a sequin gown that's hovering in shards of crystal.
Yeah, but it has like these sort of fins to it.
Yes.
That flap when they talk.
And it kind of undulates. Mm-hmm. It's one of the more, you know, in Star Trek it gets a bad rap because all the aliens basically have some kind of funny face thing, but they're basically humans.
Yeah.
I
will say that for both Star Wars and for Farscape, they got really good at making aliens look alien by being like, hey, puppets, they're great.
Exactly. Star Trek did not really get on that train, except for limited portions. And the Sheliak are, in fact, one of those alien puppet things. And they look alien, which is great. And apparently, so the Sheliak are this race that we don't really understand. Humans can't speak their language. The Federation hasn't figured out their language. But the Sheliak have figured out several Federation languages. And they are highly specific. This treaty, they demanded that it be 500,000 words to cover all eventualities, except for the one that the Enterprise finds itself in, of course.
And
I was thinking, how long is 500,000 words? Because that seems like that's long. And so I did a little research. An Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which is famously not the longest novel in the world, but close. Is 540,000 words and clocks in at 1,100 pages. So gives you some idea of how big this fictional treaty is.
Quite a long treaty.
That's a long treaty with many subsections.
I want to say probably the first four Harry Potter books, although four was quite a slugger, so it might just be the first three and a half.
That's still a lot.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in that treaty, apparently. And so the Shellyak are like, I move out. The humans that are down there are like, we're not going to take order. Well, their leader is like, I'm not taking orders from a walking calculator. We can fight the Shellyak. And Data's like, no, you can't. I'll try some reverse psychology. He gets kissed, which was weird.
Yeah. In his, can we just talk about Brent Spiner's acting for a second when he's getting kissed? And just like, he's really good at this sort of physicality of like, he's like blinking and doesn't know where to look and is like, what is going on right now?
Yes. So he meets this woman whose name I don't recall. And she
I want to say it's Mackenzie, but it's like some weird variation of Mackenzie so that it's not Mackenzie.
Exactly. There's, I'm sure, an apostrophe somewhere in there. And so there are people living down there, right? Their colony ship was ended up on this planet, wasn't supposed to be here, it crashed. They adapted to the radiation. They're very proud of their home, and they've spent a lot of time, 92 years, building this settlement. And they don't want to leave, and you can understand that. And so the leader, Goshevin, is – I think that's how you say his name. He is not so pleased to see Data. This woman, Mackenzie, is very pleased to see Data because apparently she's big into androids. And there's a funny line where she's like, this is the most advanced android I've ever seen. And Data says, how many androids have you seen? And she says, you, one.
Yes.
And then, like, so there's
fascinating.
Yes, it's true. She's an interesting character. And so there's a moment at which Data tries to reason with the people and Goshevin will have none of it. And he goes to Mackenzie, who agrees with Data because Data is an android, so she figures he's not biased, and you should always trust an android, which I think is probably faulty logic, but okay. And he says, well, what should I do? She says, try reverse psychology. He's thinking about that. And then out of nowhere, she decides to kiss him.
Yeah, it really is out of nowhere. But then there's also the whole, like, scene with him and Goshevin, and then, like, the reverse psychology is going on, mm-hmm. and Goshevin's like, oh, actually, before that, when Goshevin's like, leave, and then Data totally sea lions him and is just like, I want to talk too. This is a public forum. You kind of just want to be like, dude, you were being that guy on Twitter.
Chill out, Data.
You're totally right, but you're being that guy on Twitter.
Exactly. So that's the thing, right? Data is totally right. He wants mm-hmm. to do the right thing for these people because the Shellyak are going to come and just kill them all because they don't care about these 15,000 people. And it's Data's job to convince them to leave their home world. And Goshevin, you can also kind of understand Goshevin and saying, well, you know, his grandfather is buried on the mountain, which he says like 18 times.
Yes.
And his people have invested so much energy in getting this aqueduct running. They're very proud of their aqueduct.
This aqueduct that has this fountain that is totally just evaporating all of their very precious water back into the desert. But okay.
Yeah, it seems like a poor design. It's a bad
design. The colony set that we see like 15 times, and it always has that one fountain in it.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that too, because they beam down to this planet. Well, Data beams down. And, there you go. I've seen this set like 18 times. There's always this central fountain. It always kind of looks like a pueblo.
Yeah, and the fountain always has the little steps to it and the round doorways. I'm pretty sure we saw Odo in that set.
Probably.
Bajoran child at some point.
Yeah, I don't know. It certainly has that here's a Star Trek colony set look about it. The fountain, yeah, they love this fountain for whatever reason.
No, it's a pretty cool fountain. I'd be proud of it too, but I also might be able to just build a new one on a different planet where I wasn't going to get shot.
Yeah, Goshevin does not seem to agree with this. And so Data's like, well, I'm at a loss. I've explained it to them logically. They don't seem to be working. And he even calls up to Commander Riker, and he's like, Riker, I need some help. I wasn't designed to do this. And Riker basically says, use that fancy positronic brain of yours to figure it out, Data. I can't help you.
Yeah. He's like, I haven't met these people. You deal with it.
Exactly. Which I thought, not very helpful, Riker.
Riker's a man of action.
He is a man of action. And for some reason in this episode, he looks like, in every scene we see him, that he just came out of the shower. I don't know why that is.
Maybe he was taking a lot of showers.
Maybe he was. I don't know.
He seemed a little annoyed this episode, though. He's like, I'm stuck on the bridge. I want to be a man of action. I'm just sitting here telling Data to figure it out.
Riker doesn't get to do really anything except react to, he yells at Data. Mm-hmm. He yells at Geordi, basically. Mm-hmm. He grumbles a little bit at Picard, and then that's it. And then he's a good audience at the end.
Picard gets to do a lot with the arguing with the Shelyak and going back and forth. Although at one point he's like, this isn't a law, it's a treaty. And I'm just like, bro, treaties are laws. That's actually what international law means.
It is a fundamental part of the law of the galaxy. Yeah, well, let's talk about Picard, because he has a lot of good stuff that happens in this. And he's very... So, you know, Captain Picard, a counterpoint to Captain Kirk, obviously, right? He's seen as the diplomat. He talks his way out of things. He comes to conclusions. He compromises. He's very good at it, right? The Shelyak... not so interested in negotiation.
Yeah, they're having none of it. They're just like, we are not impressed with your British accent. We are just, you know, going to do what we're going to do and be puppet-like.
Yes, I love when they, the Picard, so basically the Shelyak hail them, right, and say, hey, get these people off. And then Picard says, okay, Worf, I need you to call their home planet for me. Make a long-distance call and get them on the horn because we need to talk about this. And the first time ever, Worf is like, their planet is very far away. This may take some time.
Yes.
And I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense. From what I know in Star Trek communications, subspace communications should be as easy as pie. But whatever.
It's not just communications. They're a little dodgy on like physical distances. Like sometimes they're like, oh, we're way off in like Nowheresville. It would take forever to get back to Earth. And then sometimes they're like on DS9, oh, it'll take us like 2 days to go to Earth from here, even though we're supposed to be like an outpost on the far edge of...
Right, at the very edge of the known galaxy. Yeah, I you know, there's a little problem with consistency with locations and communications.
But anyway, the Shelyak are not reachable.
No, so they finally figure out, I guess Worf tracks them down, I don't know, whatever. And they pick up and they answer, so they hail, and they answer by saying, conversation is neither desired or required. And I just love that line because it really sets up how the Shelyak are.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Like, we don't want to exchange pleasantries with you. Go away.
Exactly. We've got a treaty. We've already said what our rights are. So hop to it, Picard. Mm-hmm. Picard, increasingly frustrated throughout this episode at the wall that the Shelyak are presenting to him in his negotiations.
Which builds into that excellent scene where when he finally catches them.
Oh, yeah. That's a great scene.
Yeah.
My favorite scene, I think, in the whole episode. Because, although, I question it. So, apparently, 3 days they have been orbiting the planet, kind of figuring out what's going to happen. And the Shelyak have given them 4 days to get 15,000 people off the planet, although they didn't know it was 15,000 people at the time. The Shelyak don't care. They just want them off, right? Mm-hmm. And in that time, on the third day, Captain Picard is like, well, why don't we look at this treaty?
Yeah, I'm like, wouldn't that be the first thing that you would do? Like, Riker's not doing anything. Tell him to read the whole thing.
Exactly. He is just sitting there taking, like, 18 showers.
Actually, when they had Worf going through that freaking treaty, I'm sitting there going, Data could read that in literally 5 seconds.
Well, he's on the planet. He's indisposed. He's using reverse psychology.
Yeah, it's too bad that Data's not, you know, on the bridge reading the treaty while... Troy, but of course that's the whole point, because it would have been super easy if Troy were down on the planet.
Exactly. She would have talked them through, sensed their emotions, and dealt with it.
Yeah.
Data would have read the treaty in 2 seconds and would have been like, oh, let's use this loophole.
Issue. And then we wouldn't have gotten this character growth for Data in which she figures out a little bit about kissing.
Yes.
And the meaning of friendship.
And how a commander shouldn't always tell the whole truth.
Yes. We skipped over at the beginning the scene in the 10 forward where they're doing their music. And do we actually ever see O'Brien on the cello again after that? I'm not remembering.
We never see it. Never see him on the cello. And O'Brien, who is also one of my favorite characters, is in this episode. He says nothing.
No, he has a couple lines, doesn't he? Because he's working with them.
No, you think that he does because people talk to him, but then other people answer for him.
Yeah, I mean, Wesley Crusher gets a line.
He
gets
those
lines, which is actually a really funny exchange, I say, as a web developer, where he's like, Captain's asking the impossible, and Geordi is just like, that's the definition of Captain.
Yeah, because the Captain, this whatever radiation fools with the transporters, like I said, so Captain Picard's like, actually, Captain Picard calls Geordi and O'Brien into the ready room. And Riker says, we're going to ask you something. And you can't say it's impossible. And they say, okay, make the transporters work. And Geordi's first reaction is, that's impossible. But they go off. And I guess they hook Wesley in to help them.
Yes, he's on set for like 2 minutes. But he's there to be like, yeah, this is impossible with them. And apparently he gets more lines than O'Brien.
Which is sad. Anytime O'Brien and Wesley share a scene and O'Brien doesn't get to say anything is a bad thing, I think.
There's like a whole thing about management styles here, though, because like this is like you got to know your employees, right? If you have Chief Engineer Scott in your engine room and he says something is impossible, then the appropriate response is, dude, just get it done, because Scott does that constantly. He's like, no, I cannot do it, Captain. Oh, 10 minutes later, just kidding, I figured out how. But Geordi doesn't do that, right? Geordi's like, every time Picard's like, we need to figure out a way to do a thing, Geordi's always the ones that's like, all right, he's got the big can-do attitude. Like, he's always like spitting out ideas. He's like, just reverse the polarity on the deflector dish, like rocking out all these ideas. And so when he says, dude, no, like, maybe you should just take that at face value.
But they don't even let him say it. They're like, we know this is impossible, but you better not tell me it's impossible.
But again, the can-do attitude, because he comes back at the end of the episode. He's like, okay, we can do it.
Which is also a great scene.
It'll need a research team of 100 in 15 years, but we can make it happen.
To which Captain Picard says, because this is after he has figured out this loophole, he says, we'll postpone it. And Geordi's very pleased. I would be slightly peeved that they're not even going to use whatever. I've wasted my time, but maybe Geordi, he's got a paper out of it or something.
Yeah, he can write a paper out of it. The loophole was that they could point a third-party arbitrator, and they appointed a species that is hibernating for 6 months. That same loophole shows up in John Scalzi's The Android's Dream. Where there's a character who is he's in university and he's like supposed to be training in diplomacy with a specific species, and he doesn't get the Nidu, which is everybody's first choice because the Nidu are like, you know, the big trading partner for Earth, and so like all the best and brightest students study the Nidu, but he doesn't have high enough grades for that. So he picks some species that is going to be hibernating for the entire time that he's in college. And they're like, okay, well, since you pick this species you can't talk to, you can also do the Nidu as a minor. that's how he gets around it.
It's a great loophole.
Yeah.
And in this
species, man, every galaxy needs one.
That's right. You need the hibernating species, which it is an interesting thing to think about how a species would develop a civilization when they hibernate for a long period of time. But that's a topic for a different podcast.
Indeed.
Because that is just to give us this wonderful scene where Captain Picard figures that out after having Riker, Worf, and Troy and Picard all looking at the same screen, all reading the treaty at the same time.
Because that's efficient.
I know. It seems like a waste of time. And Worf, I enjoyed Worf's reaction of like, oh, it'd be better if we just fight.
Yes.
Can't I just blow something up?
Worf is a sourpuss. And I think it's actually Data who later in his character arc, when he's figuring out leadership, is the one to finally call Worf on that. Because like everybody just puts up with him being a sourpuss. And I've never been in the military, but I'm pretty sure that if somebody in your unit that you were commanding was like, talking that kind of trash like Worf always talks, you would have to pull him aside and be like, look, you're bringing the morale of the unit down. You need to keep that crap to yourself. But it isn't until, like, I want to say fifth season, I can't remember when it is, that they're trying to get past that Romulan blockade, and Data gets put in charge of his own ship.
Oh,
Worf under him. And Worf is back-talking him, and Data's like, dude, you need to stop. And he's, like, the first person to do that.
Well, people are just afraid of Worf because he's angry. He's a large, angry man.
Yes.
And he knows how to use a bat lift, so.
It's true, but Data, you know, isn't afraid because he doesn't experience fear.
That's right, he has no feelings, and he's super strong as well, so he could probably beat Worf in a fight if it came down to it. My money would be on Data. although I like Worf. He is a bit of a sourpuss, though. But in Deep Space Nine, he gets much more nuanced than he does.
Yeah. I do like him as a character.
Yeah, in TNG, he's just kind of grumpy. He has some other facets of his character as the show progresses, but...
we see a lot of him with Alexander later, where he's not just, like, a complete and total grump. But, he just mouths off on the bridge, and if I were his commanding officer, I'd be like, dude...
Well, Captain Picard was so excited about finding the loophole that he didn't even notice it.
Yeah.
But it was a fun, an odd choice to have them all staring at the same screen. I was like, could they just have their own pads with the treaty on it? Break it up. It's a 500,000-page word treaty. Maybe you want to break it up into four.
Have one of those scenes where Riker's like sitting weirdly on a chair and he's got like his leg up on the side. He's just like knocked back with his pad reading a treaty. Yeah,
drinking a synthahol. Grumbling. But so Captain Picard figures out the arbitrage thing. So he picks this hibernating species, as you said, with it. And the Sheliak are not happy about this. And so he says, well, you can either wait the 6 months it'll take for them to come out of hibernation, or give me the 3 weeks that I need, because it'll take 3 weeks to get the ships to cart off 15,000 people.
Sheliak are super mad and keep saying, we carry the membership, as if that is supposed to mean something to the
humans. Oh, well, in that case, let's kill these 15,000 people for you. And so the Sheliak well, basically, I think Picard hangs up on the Sheliak, basically, because they're like, we're not going to do that. And he's like, okay, hangs up on them. And then the Sheliak. Now, I thought this episode used silence very well a couple of times.
The sound design was pretty good.
Yes. It starts off, I watched this twice, and both times I thought, I have muted my TV because I don't hear anything. Because usually an episode of Star Trek starts off with some kind of big sound or someone's talking. Silence. And then we hear music, like people getting their instruments in tune. And then it brings us to 10 forward where this recital is happening, which I thought was a lovely opening. And then we get this scene with Picard. He hangs up on the Sheliak. And there's no music. It's just silence as he waits for them to call back. And they call back. And Worf says, you know, they're hailing us. Captain Picard doesn't respond. He just kind of wanders off. He cleans the little plaque on the bridge.
Checks it for dust.
That's right. And Worf is like, should I pick up?
It reminded me of that scene. Have you seen Blood of Heroes?
I have not.
I believe it's on Netflix, and it is a great way to waste an hour and a half of your life that you will never get back. there's a scene at the end where the good guys have won, and all they have to do is put this dog skull on this pike. It's a long story, and like, and the big hero just tells his little friend, he says, "Just walk over there really slowly." And she does. She just walks very slowly and puts the dog, because they, you know, they have their enemies beaten back, and the enemies can't stop them from putting the dog skull on the pike. And yeah, that's what this reminded me of. He's like, I'm just going to take my time. Maybe I'll order some tea.
He luxuriates in the time that he takes. Mm-hmm. It gives us a great, we just hear the background throb of the Enterprise kind of, you know, doing whatever the Enterprise does. And you know, Captain Picard's just kind of wandering about for a good, probably maybe 20, 30 seconds. And then he decides, okay, I will, put them on screen, Worf. And of course the Sheliak are like, okay, fine. You have your 3 weeks. And Captain Picard's like, good. And, then they fly off. And then we get, Data's happy because they got the 3 weeks. So he convinces, we should talk about how he decides to convince them.
Yeah. So they were like, oh, phasers also don't work. But unlike Geordi, Data is able to fix this problem by wiring his own positronic brain into his phaser to compensate for its random, it's weird. Just don't think about it too hard. He basically duct taped a chip to it.
That's right.
Which made it smarter. That he could use his phaser. And then he shot some people. He was like, I'm going to blow up your big fancy well that you're so proud of. And Gosheven was like, this will not stand. And so he brought the able-bodied men of the village, and they had their little guns with, I assume, bullets in them. And then Data was just like, I'm just going to shoot all of you. And he was like, that was stun setting. And guess what? The Sheliak can just bomb your ass from orbit. They're not even going to come down here. And you're all going to die, which is what I told you 30 minutes ago.
But you didn't listen.
Showtime, but now you're going to listen because we're in the third act.
And because I've stunned a bunch of people with a phaser that you've never seen before. Actions.
Yes, violence solves everything.
That's the lesson we learn. There are two lessons. Have a 500,000 word treaty if you want anything to get done. And if that doesn't work, shoot people.
Indeed.
And your problems are solved. Although I did like that scene because Data's like, you know, that was stun and this is not. And then he shoots their little fountain and oddly, like, waves of energy go through the whole aqueduct. I wasn't quite sure what was happening, but
I was interpreting that as him blowing out the lights. And apparently the entire aqueduct was lit all the way back to the mountain because I guess they really like moths in their water.
I guess so. I was very confused, but that makes sense. I can get on board with that explanation. And so Goshen's like, oh my gosh, whatever the heck his name is, we can't defend ourselves against one android with a phaser. How are we going to defend ourselves against the Shellyak? You have totally convinced me. We will leave. And everyone's like, hooray! And then we get another weird scene with Data and Mackenzie, the lady who apparently is infatuated with Data.
And this time he kisses her magically without getting any of his yellow makeup on her face.
He does kiss her, which I thought was odd. But, yes. Okay, whatever.
I don't know. He sort of doesn't get it, though. He's like, this is, we see Data learn a lot of behaviors through mimicry.
Mm-hmm.
So it is totally on par for the course for him to have seen that and then decided to mimic it. And then, you know, it kind of doesn't work. And she points out that it doesn't work. She's like, oh, yeah, you don't have any feelings for me at all. You just thought that, you know, rationally it was the thing to do because you saw me do it. And use. I kind of like that sort of conclusion to her storyline because she gets that little moment there where she's mm-hmm. like, I have this crush, but this crush is not actually about him. It's about me and my thing for androids.
Yep.
And, like, you know, so she gets a nice closure of, like, yeah, he's a nice guy and he saved our lives, but, you know, he is not spurning me. He's just doesn't understand anything.
Yes, he's just being true to himself. Because, yeah, she doesn't really get it. I mean, Data's explained it to her, but she's like, mm-hmm. Will you at least remember me?
Mm-hmm. And Data's like, yes.
I'm incapable of forgetting you.
Which like, is, I mean, I could delete the memory files, but why would I?
Yeah, they're not taking up that much space. It's okay. She's like, oh, well, do you have any feelings? And he's like, feelings about me? And she's like, oh, I don't have feelings about anything. And she's like, oh, all right. I'm getting what you're picking up after this unhappy kiss of ours. And that's the whole episode, I believe. So what did you think of this episode overall?
I liked it. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a Darmok type episode. It's not one of the classic, really memorable episodes, but, you know, we get to see Data sort of spread his wings a little and sort of start on his path to becoming a real boy. And well, I mean, he's already started on his path, obviously, but you know, we get to see progress on his path, and we get some quips from Geordi about how hard life is for engineers, which I always appreciate.
Poor Geordi.
And, you know, Picard gets to be a badass with treaties, which is basically like his whole shtick.
That's right. That is his reason for being.
That is why he's in charge of the flagship. Oh, it's a political position. Oh, he's good at politics. So.
But it's a meritocracy.
Totes a meritocracy.
And you brought up Darmok. I wanted this episode, I thought, was, you know, a step above middling. It was interesting. It had a lot of great scenes. And one of my favorite scenes I did not mention is when Picard and Troy are talking about the difficulties of dealing with the Shellyak and mm-hmm. how they can't understand their language because the Shellyak are so alien. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem that in Star Trek they kind of dip into every once in a while. Mm-hmm. But I would think in reality, if there are alien civilizations out there and we were to ever contact them, they would be so alien that it would be very difficult for us to even understand what each other is saying, mm-hmm. which they discuss. And Troy says in particular, imagine if we were stranded on a planet and we were alien races and we didn't know each other's language. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's Darmok. Wait a couple seasons and this exact thing will happen.
Yeah, although she has that whole thing with the cup and she's like, how do you know what I was saying? And our worldviews match up. I have this whole theory about why Star Trek aliens are totally legit that does not involve them all having the same DNA because that episode was a little weird.
I was going to say, they explained it. Well, now I want to hear your theory.
So my theory is parallel evolution. If you look at bushes that are in like the Gobi Desert and ones that are in Death Valley, mm-hmm. right? They are not identical. You can tell that they are two different plants. But they evolve the same adaptations to their environment. So even though they look pretty different, they have evolved like the same kinds of like leaves and things like that because they're reacting to the same external pressures. So I have this theory that it is totally not completely crazy that we would end up with mammals on other planets or mammalian like type creatures because if they were evolving to react to the same external pressures, they might evolve to look something like something that we could communicate with.
plus the people seeded DNA across the galaxy. And
well, yes, and you know, we can also just be like, oh, Q thought it was funny. I mean, this is Star Trek.
It is true. That's the beautiful thing about Star Trek, is there's always a reason. Next on Random Trek, The Next Generation's Loud as a Whisper. See what I did there?